Jason, we've already discussed talking about some of the traditional arguments for God, and we've already talked about the long cosmological argument that everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. And then Aquinas' argument from existential causality, the God is the cause of the continuing existence of the universe. And then we talked about the argument from design, the teleological argument, and the different types of design arguments, whether it be specified complexity, the highly complex information found in living things, or irreducible complexity. We're just getting started. Or the anthropic principle. So we left off on the possibility of human knowledge or human reason. And I want to spend a little bit of time on this argument. This is C.S. Lewis in his Mere Christianity uses his argument from reason. And he basically argues that I think I'm allowed to erase that since we're on the occasion. He basically argues that there's no way to trust in reason with a small r unless it came from reason with a capital R. That if our ability to reason, to think, got here by accident, got here by chance, got here by non-rational causes, then what makes us think that reason really works? And so he's not arguing that if our reason wasn't created by God, divine reason, then it definitely doesn't work. That's not what he's arguing. What he's arguing is whether it works or not, we have no way of knowing. So why do we even trust our reason? Now, if this argument is sound, then that means that the atheist, when he uses his reason, his reasoning ability, his thinking ability to argue against God, he's actually acting like God exists because he's trusting his reason. It's kind of like Cornelius Van Til. This is also consistent with Van Til's presuppositional argument called the transcendental argument. You don't really need to know what all that means right now. But Van Til argued that arguing against the existence of God is like arguing against the existence of air. The whole time you're arguing against God, you're taking in air in order to make the argument. Okay? And so you're saying, somebody said, well, I want to argue that God doesn't exist, so I'm going to use my reasoning ability to argue that God doesn't exist, but there's no reason to trust your reason, what your reason is telling you, and to trust that your reasoning ability works unless God does exist. And I'll just give you two examples about how Christians and non-Christians often find this argument fascinating. One was I was at Southern Evangelical Seminary taking a course in North Carolina. It's probably one of the two biggest apologetic schools in the country. I mean, they just do nothing but train guys how to defend the faith. Norman Geisler founded the school. Now Richard Land is the president. But when Alex McFarland was the president, I had taken a few courses there. And so whenever I was in town, he'd always make sure to put me on his radio show. So Alex McFarland would interview me on his radio show. And I gave this argument from human reason. You know, Alex just threw me a softball for me. He just said, well, you're an apologist, Dr. Fernandez. How do you, if somebody asks you, how do you know God exists? Can you give me some reasons to believe in God? And this is one of the arguments that I gave. And I gave some of the traditional arguments. You know, the whole interview probably lasted 30 minutes. But the custodian there the next day heard me talking in the hall, and then he said, hey, you're the guy who was interviewed on Alice's program yesterday. And so even the custodians there are into apologetics. Everybody loves apologetics. If you don't love apologetics, you don't go near this school. And so the custodian told me, he said, man, he said, that was really eye-opening and this and that. Do you have any literature on that? So I gave him my Atheist Delusion book. But he had never heard it. This is a guy that spent decades studying apologetics, but he had never heard this argument. And he just thought, man, it was just a really powerful argument. When I taught my philosophy of religion course 2 years ago, we had an atheist student from Sweden who was very brilliant. His name was Alvin. Very brilliant student, one of the most brilliant atheists I ever knew, but also one of the most honest. That's not a good combination, because then if you're honest, you got to admit when you're stumped. And I had him for an hour and a half block classes, so I was able to, you know, take him to areas he didn't want to go. Like, I got him to acknowledge that if atheism is true, that Adolf Hitler's actions were not really wrong for all people, all times, and all places. He just doesn't like Hitler's actions, but there's no way to call it wrong without God. And that's what you remove God, and there's so much that you can't do. But on this one, I told him that basically, if our reasoning ability, if our thinking ability evolved from non-rational causes, we have no reason to trust in what our reason tells us. There's no basis for us to believe that our reasoning ability is valid. He raised his hand, he started responding to that, and I told him, I said, yeah, but you're trusting in the validity of your reason when you make that statement. You're an atheist. What basis do you have in your worldview to trust your reason? And he shut up. A few minutes later, he raised his hand and started saying something. I said, yeah, but Alvin, you're trusting in the validity of your human reason. Where in atheism do you have any basis for trusting in your reason? And he put his head down, and then other students talked, and we talked a little bit more. He raised his hand another time, and he started to say something. I just kind of looked at him, and he said, I'm doing that again. I'm trusting him. I said, yeah, you are. And then he was quiet for the rest of the class. And when the class was over, he stayed behind, and he said, I just wanted to tell you, Doc, I was not offended. I thought you were very respectful to me. I'm not mad. I just don't know how to respond to that argument. Has Christopher Hitchens was his favorite atheist, has he ever responded to this? I said, no, he probably just ignores it, but I don't think it's anywhere in his writings. And he said, well, has anybody responded to it? I said, there was a lady that debated C.S. Lewis on it, and they thought that she won the debate, and they found out that there was like a little fallacy that she was using, and then her reasoning was a little fallacious, and then you could also tighten up Lewis's argumentation a little bit more. You know, Lewis thought he lost it, but he debated a philosopher. He wasn't a philosopher. She used bigger words than him. He was intimidated, and then didn't want to debate anymore. But now it's pretty clear that really, he actually won the debate without realizing it, and the argument still stands. So I told him, I said, no, it hasn't been refuted. But he told me he wanted me to recommend books on this argument because he wanted to devote his life to trying to refute it, because it really hit him like a ton of bricks. And so this is a very interesting argument. I don't think we have really spent enough time on it, but you know, the question comes up, could consciousness and our thinking ability randomly evolve from matter? You know, at what point did a single cell evolve to where all of a sudden it got this non-physical stuff called reasoning ability, thinking ability? At what point did a single cell evolve to where it's, oh wow, I'm a living thing? I think it's much more reasonable to believe that we were created by a rational being and in his image, so that we have reasoning ability, so that we could, through using reason, we could find out about the world in which we live. Atheism cannot account for the validity of human reason. Dr. Michael Martin, he was America's leading philosophical atheist in the 1990s. I debated him in 1997 on Internet Infidels. And his book was titled Atheism Philosophical Justification. It's a really big book, one of the most scholarly books ever written defending atheism. Okay? But he starts out, I believe it's the first chapter of that book, where he's looking for what philosophers call an epistemology. It's kind of a theory. Philosophical theory of knowledge. How can man know? What does man know? You know? And of course, the philosophers he likes are all atheists. So he goes over all these different theories of epistemology, different theories of how man knows, and concludes the chapter by saying nobody really agrees. There's never really been a thorough, solid theory of knowledge proposed by any of these atheist writers. And so then he says, so I'm free to move on and start discussing other things. So he never establishes how man can know. He never establishes that man can know and what we can know. He just moves right on and says, well, you know, the greatest philosophers, well, they all happen to be atheists, the ones he likes, can't agree and can't find a theory of knowledge, can't explain why we can know. So since we're all in disagreement on it, I've got the freedom now to just move on to other issues. Not so fast. When I debated it, it was an internet debate hosted by Internet Infidels, the world's largest atheist website at the time. When I debated him on it, I said, you didn't have any right to even move on to like chapter two. I mean, I didn't say it in that way. We didn't talk about his book. But I'm just basically saying, if an atheist, if your worldview doesn't give you the ammunition that is required for you to know anything, then you either need to get a new worldview, or you just need to remain a skeptic in that worldview and just question all things and suspend judgment on all things. You don't get a free pass, a green light. If your worldview cannot supply you with a solid epistemology, a reason why man can know, a reason why our reason works, then you shouldn't go any further. And on this basis alone, I would be a Christian rather than be an atheist. And you'll hear me make that statement time and time again, but there are just certain things, whether it's being able to morally condemn Adolf Hitler's actions in the fullest sense, or whether it's being able to account for the beginning of the universe and how we got here, or whether it's being able to account for the order and design of the universe, or whether it's able to account for the validity of human reason, the belief that our reason works. Any one of them, just alone, would be enough for me to say, wow, I need to trash atheism. But the atheist has nothing to offer here as to an explanation as to how man knows. I mean, the best atheist can do is turn to neuroscience and talk to experts on how the brain works. But that really doesn't answer anything. That'd be just like, I mean, for all practical purposes, you could study the kneecap. And what does that doesn't tell you much about knowledge? But they can say, well, the brain has a lot more to do with knowledge, does it? Or is it just something that our souls operate on? But we're not talking physiology. We're talking about, can you really know things? Okay? And so whatever the case, atheism cannot account for the validity of the reason. Now, let's put the turn to the other side of the coin. What about Christian theism? Can we account for human reason? Yes. If a rational God created us in his image so that we're rational beings and created the world in a way that makes sense, then we can use our reason and find out truths about reality. I mean, to be totally honest with you, if the Christian world, if you believe the Christian worldview, then so many of these problems are not problems, they're givens. Okay? It's just a given that man can know. How can man be a finite knower with a small k? Because we were created by an infinite knower with a capital K and created in his image. Okay? This even goes back to the Logos doctrine. The ancient Greek philosophers said, well, everything is, the whole physical universe exists in a state of flux. Everything is changing. And then it's like, well, then how can we know anything? And then he said, there must exist some kind of rational mind. We'll call him the Logos. We'll call it the Logos. And the Logos, this rational mind, it's the Greek word for word, the Logos brings order and makes sense of the physical world of change, and the Logos enlightens our minds to understand and perceive the reality, to know reality. Okay? Well, the Apostle John started writing his gospel. He wrote that the Greeks were right. The Logos does exist and does enlighten our minds. But they're wrong. The Logos is not a non-personal force. And so he penned the words, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. And then the Logos became flesh. And so in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And so here, 2,000 years ago, John is saying, I got the answer that Michael Martin in 1991 still didn't have. And you could be an atheist 2,000 years from now, if Jesus doesn't come back by then, 2,000 years from now, atheism will still not have an answer. You'll kind of have to accept my word on that, but atheism will still not have an answer as to how man knows. If you're a Christian, then it's all contained in the Christian worldview that the infinite knower created us as finite knowers. Now, Richard Taylor gave an illustration about to show the strength of this argument. He said a lady is riding a train, and she's going to Wales, and she's never been there before. And she sees on the side of the hill, on the hillside of white stones, it spells out, Welcome to Wales. And in this illustration, Richard Taylor is going to have that message, Welcome to Wales, represent human reason. Okay? So she's going towards Wales. She's never been there, but she sees on the side of the hill the white stones, they spell out, Welcome to Wales. She is free to believe that that little thing, Welcome to Wales, got there by chance. Maybe some kids were playing at the top of the hill, and the white stones just started rolling down, and accidentally, randomly, by chance, just happened to spell out Welcome to Wales. She is free to believe that. However, if she believes that that got there by chance, then there's no reason for her to believe what those stones are saying. If it spelled out Welcome to Wales by accident, she has no reason to accept what that message is telling her. She has no reason to believe she is entering Wales. Okay? So if our reason got here randomly by non-rational causes, then we have no reason to believe what our reason is telling us.
Why?
What's it?
Why?
Well, because if an intelligent being said, I want to convey a message, and I want to tell people they're entering whales, if she looks and says, oh, that was made by intelligence, that got here by intelligence, so apparently I'm entering whales. But if she believes, oh yeah, it looks like it's telling me we're entering whales, but I think that those stones accidentally rolled down the hill, they just got there by chance, so there's no reason to believe the message, because technically it's not even a message. It's just random rocks that look like a message. So if our reason got here by chance, we might think our reason is telling us something. We might think that our reason is giving us a message that this is a chair, a solid blue chair, that my hands are touching. Well, I might think my reason is telling me that, but if I believe that my reason got here by chance, then that message isn't really, it might seem like a message, but it's not really a message, because if it's a message, it had to have that intelligence behind it. And so he uses illustration to show if this is symbolic of our reason, we have no reason to trust what we think our reason is telling us, unless we acknowledge that our reason had a rational cause. But the atheist doesn't believe our reason had a rational cause. They believe it got here by chance, just like stones rolling down a hill. Okay? When we see a sign that says exit or fire exit, you know, we believe, okay, well, that was put there for a reason. And there was reason behind putting that message there. So I'm going to understand, I'm going to take seriously what that message is telling me. Well, that's what we do with our own human reason. But if our human reason got here by chance, we don't have a basis for doing that. So the atheist, by trusting in his reason, is acting like a Christian. We trust in our reason because we believe it came from God's reason. Okay? So I think that the argument from reason is a strong, strong argument. Now, universal, eternal, unchanging moral laws, it's the moral argument, and basically we all make moral decisions. Okay? You even find atheists. I've dialogued with numerous atheists, and it's very easy, even to get brilliant atheists, to trap them into making moral judgments. Now, when you catch them making a moral value judgment, they'll often deny that's what they really did, but in reality, that's what they really did. So when I work with the Subbase Police Department, had a guy thought he was the most brilliant guy on earth because he had a 4-year degree in criminal justice from Penn State. And I guess from studying at Penn State under these brilliant professors, they convinced him that there's no such thing as right and wrong. So the first thing I told him was pretty obvious. I said, okay, smart guy, so you're telling me you got a degree in criminal justice from professors who believe there's no such thing as right and wrong? And he said, yeah. I said, you got a degree from professors in criminal justice, and these guys taught you there's no such thing as right and wrong? He said, yeah. And I said, well, if no such thing as right and wrong, how come the criminal is a criminal, and how could he have violated a thing called justice? And he didn't think there was any problem with that. Then I even asked him, I said, if a guy's robbing a bank here on base, and you go and you pull out your pistol, and you tell him to stop, and he turns and points his pistol at you, and then you have to shoot him, you're not right and he's not wrong? He said, yeah, basically. And so this guy was just shoveling the manure. and thrown it on. That's what philosophers call responses that are forced and temporary. They're forced because if he wants to win the debate and argue there's no such thing as right and wrong, he has to say that. And they're temporary because 10 minutes later, when he's not in that discussion, he's going to act like these things are really right and wrong. Okay? So anyway, I was supposed to make some checks. For the first 4 hours, I was supposed to drive around and check buildings and doors and make sure everything's locked up on base. And then in the next 4 hours, I replace him at the gate, and then he goes and makes his checks. Well, what I did was, I made all my checks, but I took that form and I put another form on top of it and signed my name and stuff, and then pretended I did hardly any checks at all. Which was basically, they're going to force him to do double work, my work and his work. And so he was ticked. This was a cop driving a police vehicle, and he was patching out, tires were squealing, he was driving on it. So finally I waved him down, and he stopped, and I said, "What's the matter? You look mad." And he said, "Yeah, I am mad." And I said, "Oh, poor puppy, what's wrong?" You know, and he was a big guy, but I knew he wasn't going to hit me. But I said, "Oh, poor puppy, what's the matter?" And he started, and he's like, "Somebody didn't do their checks." And I said, "Oh, are you saying that you feel wronged?" And he's just like real ticked off. He didn't want to say where he's looking straight ahead. And I said, "Oh, you could just pass a moral value judgment on me and just condemn me because I didn't, quote unquote, pull my weight and all this other stuff. And so you're going to just act like there's moral absolutes now, and you're right and I'm wrong." And he's just fuming and stuff like that. And I said, "Give me that." And I took off my sheet, the top sheet, which was bogus, and I crumpled it up and I threw it down. And I said, "I did my checks there, smart guy," or whatever. And he just patched out and drove away. So he never admitted he was wrong. But actions speak louder than words, you know? Now, you hear from, I'll tell you, with my students, I'll say, "What do you do if somebody says there's no such thing as right and wrong?" And I always get the guys who always raise their hand, and I'll call them and say, "I'd punch the guy in the nose, Doc." And I said, "Well, no, you really wouldn't punch the guy in the nose." You know, but that would be a quick way to win a debate, but also a quick way to go to jail. And so you don't do that. But the fact of the matter is there's these people that act like, "Well, there is no God, so there's no such thing as right and wrong." Yeah, they say that right up until the moment that you wrong them. Okay? That's why Jesus said, "Do to others what you would have others do to you. Treat others the way you want to be treated." Can you imagine if Jesus didn't know human nature, he would have said something like, "Treat others the way you know they should be treated." If Jesus told us that, so Phil Fernandez, "Treat others the way you know they should be treated," I'd be like, "Okay, well, I've always felt that I was, like, special. I always kind of felt like I was better than everybody else growing up. I just knew it as a little kid. I could strike out, but that swing was just better. It was even better than the swing of the guys who hit the home runs and stuff. So, yeah, if I treat everybody the way I know they should be treated, I'll treat everybody like they're my slaves, and I'm the king of the world." Because that's the way we are. We're so selfish, you know. But Jesus said, no, the only time these guys will recognize right and wrong is when they're being wronged. So Jesus says, doesn't tell Phil Fernandez, "Treat others the way you know they should be treated." He says, "Treat others the way you want them to treat you." Okay? So when people trample on my rights, I know that's wrong. So then I should not trample on their rights. And so people will do that. They'll say they don't believe in right and wrong. But in reality, we all make moral value judgments. Now, where does the moral law come from? If we all make moral value judgments, the atheist, the first place he's going to say is that it comes from the individual. Okay? Well, each individual, no such thing as right and wrong. We're just expressing our opinion. Each person decides what is right or what is wrong. Okay? For himself or herself. So, well, what's the problem with that?
Well, what's right for you is not always going to be right for me. And what's right for me is not going to be right for you.
And if the atheist is going to say, I'm okay with that, even though he really isn't okay with it, he's going to say he's okay with that.
You can't say what I did is wrong or right or wrong.
Yeah, you can't. You can tell them that. But let's say Pat Fisk, I mean, you're a godly man, you love the Lord, so you know that you have done wrong things. But the atheist might be oblivious to it because he's claiming there's no such thing as right and wrong. But let's insert, instead of Pat Fisk, let's insert somebody like Adolf Hitler. Okay? If each individual decides what is right and what is wrong, and there's no higher arbiter on what is right and what is wrong, the final judge is the individual, then everything Adolf Hitler did was right because he thought it was right.
Exactly.
There's no, if atheists are going to say, you know what, I'll settle on the individual, then they have lost the right to condemn the actions of Adolf Hitler.
Or of anyone. Okay.
Was that?
Or of anyone.
Yeah, yeah. So usually they'll go to the next step and they'll say, well, maybe it's not an individual. It's society determines what is right or what is wrong. So then one society doesn't have the right to condemn the actions of another society. But then you bring up the Nazis, Taliban, ISIS. Based on that, those guys aren't wrong. By the way, not only is ISIS not wrong for slaughtering innocent human beings, if each society determines what is right and what is wrong, their society has determined that's right. Not only are the Nazis right, the Taliban right, but Martin Luther King Jr. is wrong. If the society determines what is right and what is wrong, then what right did Martin Luther King Jr. have the right to try to change the way our society thought about quote-unquote race? Okay? So the moral reformer, if the society is always right, the moral reformer is always wrong. And but whatever the case, our society condemns the Nazi society, the Taliban society, the ISIS society. So we have to appeal to a moral standard above all individuals and above all societies. So then what the atheist will say is, okay, well maybe it's the world consensus that decides what is right and what is wrong. So maybe it's the world consensus, nothing higher than that. Well, the fact of the matter is, the world consensus has been pretty messed up in the past. The woman used to be considered merely property of the man. She had no rights herself in ancient times. And merely because the man usually has heavier bone structure, more muscle mass, and so it's just kind of like might is right. Man has rights. The female is just property of the male. It used to be the world consensus was that slavery is just part of life. Get used to it. They're slave owners and they're slaves. If you're born into a slave family, you're toast. Forget about freedom. But that's just the way the world is. The world consensus was, at one time, the world consensus, you got to go back further than most people think, though, but at one time the world consensus, and at least in major portions of the world, was that the world was flat. So the world consensus doesn't have a really good track record. That's number one. Number two, it's hard to figure out when we really have a world consensus. Because CNN will tell me what the world consensus is, and it's always the opposite of my view. And I was never consulted. I don't have, like, we don't have these little, like, voting mechanisms in our pocket that wherever there's an issue, everybody in the world gets to vote. So we really do know what the world consensus is. So a lot of more times than not, the world consensus isn't really the world consensus, but it's what people in positions of power, the media, education, what they want us to believe. So that's another problem. But I think the biggest problem with the world consensus is that even atheists try to change the world consensus. I mean, the reason why atheists take debates is they think that their world consensus is wrong. Because about, you know, somewhere between 90 and 95% of people on the planet disagree with the atheists. So if you're going to go with world consensus, atheism loses. So even atheists try to build a better world. But that means that they're not only appealing to a moral standard above all individuals and above all societies, but they're appealing to a moral standard even above the world consensus. So they can say, well, the world consensus on this issue is right on. The world consensus on that issue is wrong. Who says? I mean, I can say the world consensus, when they thought slavery was okay, well, they were wrong. The atheists can say, who says? And I can say, God. What do you do if you don't have a God? What in the world could you have? What in the world? What in the world and outside the world could you have bigger than world consensus if all you're doing is counting noses? So even atheists try to build a better world. So even atheists judge individuals, judge societies, and judge the world consensus. Well, where is your standard then? Where is that moral standard? But by the way, you know what atheists also do? Atheists will often condemn actions of the past, and they try to build a better future. Just think about that. If actions often speak louder than words, atheists say they don't believe in God, and they don't believe in absolute morality, because once you acknowledge absolute moral laws, that implies that there has to be an absolute moral lawgiver. Okay? So the atheists say, I don't believe in any absolute moral laws. Yeah, but how do they act? They act like there's a moral standard above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and this moral standard doesn't change with time. So we can call the actions of the past wrong, and we can try to build a better future. So that moral standard remains the same. So basically what their actions are telling us, if there's a moral law above all individuals, all societies, any world consensus that doesn't change with time, there has to be a moral lawgiver above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and the moral lawgiver doesn't change with time. Okay, so whatever the case, I think the moral argument for God's existence is a very strong argument that can be used here. So, whenever I have like little doubts about my faith, we all have it. Just to be human is to doubt. We doubt some of the most obvious things. You could be the greatest athlete on the planet Earth and the number one fighter in the world in your weight class, and you still have doubts. You know, we all doubt things. But whenever I have doubts, I get back to the basics, and I realize, look, you know, we humans sure do act like there is such a thing as right and wrong. And when we do, we act like there's an ultimate moral authority out there. A moral God who's created us in His image. You know, the non-moral things of nature, if you trip over a rock, you don't start yelling at the rock, if you're mentally stable, at least, you don't yell at the rock and hold it accountable for tripping you. Well, why do you, if a human being trips you, why do you get mad at them and hold them morally accountable? Okay? And so we act like there is a moral order, and there has to be this moral lawgiver that has created us that way. So now one more argument I want to cover, and we'll take a little break, and then we'll spend this is about 20 or 30 minutes. So I'll talk a little bit about my cumulative case for God. But the argument from the meaning of life, purpose, so it's also called the absurdity of life without God. If God does not exist, life is absurd. If there's no God, no life after death, life is absurd. It doesn't matter if you live your life like Corrie ten Boom and risk your life to protect innocent Jewish people, or if you live your life like Adolf Hitler and slaughter innocent Jewish people. A million years from now, everybody you ever influenced for quote-unquote good or evil, whatever that would mean in a world without God, well, they'll have ceased to exist. Eventually, the whole universe will blow up and will cease to exist, and it really didn't make any difference. Okay? So there's no eternal difference between living your life like Corrie ten Boom or Adolf Hitler if there's no God and no life after death. Now, when I used this in my debate with Michael Martin, I argued that if God does not exist, life is without meaning. Life life is absurd. Life is without meaning. He said, well, there's no cosmic meaning to life, no eternal meaning to life, but that doesn't mean there can't be some subjective meaning, some temporary meaning. And my response was pretty much, well, yeah, no kidding, you can worship a car. So what this guy's saying is, look, you act like there's no meaning if there's no God. I could find meaning. I mean, if somebody wants to, they can worship this. What do they call it? Non-permanent marker?
Dry erase.
Dry erase marker, whatever. You could just, say the great purple marker. I mean, human beings can be idiots. You can worship your car. You can act like, boy, I really want to wake up in the morning because I have a nice car. Well, that car is eventually going to rust, and you're eventually going to die. Is that really meaningful? So it doesn't matter if you accomplish everything you want to accomplish in life in 60 or 70 years, and then you cease to exist for all eternity. What was it worth? Nothing. You're not even worth anything after that. So basically what I was arguing is that if there's no meaning with a capital M, no eternal significance, no eternal meaning, then all the meanings with a small M don't amount to anything. Okay? And when I debated Jeffrey J. Lauder at University of North Carolina Chapel Hill campus, it was at a major atheist conference in September of 1999. Michael Martin was there, Kai Nielsen, Eddie DeBosch, Dan Barker. But I debated Jeff Lauder. And Jeff Lauder said this argument, the argument for the absurdity of life without God, he said, I don't have to respond to it because it's an appeal to emotion. So in other words, what he's saying is, it's just an emotional argument and really no basis in reason. And so I got up and I said, no, it's not an appeal to emotion. It's an appeal to fact. I'm appealing to reality. I said, if God doesn't exist and there's no life after death, why do you people study hard, study hard, and do what you do? I said, look, it makes sense. If I believe Jesus is Lord, it makes sense that I'm going to have a Jesus saves bumper sticker. That makes perfect sense. But why would you people gather, travel clear across the world? They came from many different countries, about 200 atheists for this, leading atheists for this conference. Why would you travel clear across the world to celebrate your belief that there is no God and after you die you cease to exist? I said, that doesn't make sense at all. When you put your own little bumper stickers on a car saying there's no God, that doesn't make any sense at all. And I went on and on and finally I said, as a matter of fact, I'll be totally honest with you, I don't even know why you people get up in the morning. And then I felt like I was being really rude and I had gone too far, so I just shut up. I just figured, boy, I mean, that wasn't, I thought that I was going to be heckled. And so I just shut up and there was silence, and all I saw was the whole crowd of either guys like this, with their mouths wide open, like thinking, yeah, why do I even get up in the morning? And next to them was their buddies, who were like, rocking back and forth and getting all fidgety, you know? And I'm thinking, man, if that's the response I'm getting, no heckling, just open mouths or rocking back and forth, I'm just going to be silent for a night. I felt the presence of God. I felt like God was just sweeping through and just convicting these guys. And then I even remember they took a break during the debate. I was in the stall, two guys were at the urinals, and I hear one guy saying, well, how do you think it's going so far? And the other guy said, the good thing is, I don't think anybody's going to change their mind. And so he's basically saying, the atheist is getting whooped, but we're not going to let the facts stop us from being atheists. But this is it's a very powerful argument, but people can choose to act like it's not, you know? And there is a sense where it's not really so much in the rational realm as it is in the realm of the will, the realm of the existential realm, the desire to live and things of that sort. But the fact of the matter is, why build big buildings and work hard to do things if when you die you just cease to exist? And you can say, well, at least I'm making a better world for the people to come. Yeah, well, eventually the whole universe is going to blow up. And if there's no God, that's it. And, you know, even people build sandcastles. And I used to think, boy, they put so much effort into that, and then the waves come and just wash them away. And I think two things about that. Number one, part of that art is a philosophical statement that if there is no God, things are temporary and they all wash away. And so it's kind of the recognition of the absurdity of life without God. But another side of it, what do they usually do? Anybody know what they usually do when they make these beautiful sandcastles?
Take pictures.
They take photos of every possible angle. So when their artwork has been washed away, they still got those photos. And so I think what it shows is there's a recognition that if there isn't any God, eventually any beauty that we have, any worth that we have, will be washed away. And the other side of the coin is, but I don't like it like that, so I'm going to take as many photos as I can. And but life is meaningful, and therefore God exists. So whatever the case, now you can see in the Bible a basis for these traditional arguments. Like Isaiah 1:18, God says, come, let us reason together. God wants to reason with us. We're told that God created man in his image. If God's a rational God, we're reason. We're told that in Acts 17, in him we live and move and have our being. But you can look at these different passages, Romans 1 and Psalm 19:1. That you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. So King David and Paul in Romans 1 are saying, look, we don't see the invisible God, but we see the visible work of his hands. Therefore we know that God is the cause of this effect we call the universe. And we see the design in the universe. Psalm 94:9, he who formed the eye, does he not see? He who planted the ear, can he not hear? So if we were designed to see and hear, surely God must be able to see and hear. Even God's moral laws written on our hearts, Romans 2:14-15. And then the argument for the absurdity of life without God, that's a summary of the book of Ecclesiastes. King Solomon had more money, built more buildings, read more books, and had more wives than anybody. And so everything you could possibly think of, say, boy, if I just had that, I'd be happy. Solomon had that 1,000 times over. And he was miserable. And what he found was that if you don't put God in the equation, everything under heaven is striving after the wind. It's futile. And by the way, you can see that in the Mike Tysons of the world, where their God is that all they wanted was to be the heavyweight champ of the world. Once he became the heavyweight champ of the world, his life just came unglued. Because all of a sudden, you get everything that you lived for, and you find out it's really not that big of a deal after all. Something's still missing. So anytime you try to settle for something other than God, you're going to fall flat. That's why when people settle on something other than God, it's broken cisterns, Jeremiah 2:13. But Jesus, and we'll close this session with this, Jesus in John 6:35, Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. It's pretty obvious Jesus is not talking about physical food and physical water. Because after I accepted Christ, I continued to eat food and drink water. Okay? He's talking about spiritual hunger and spiritual thirst. And what Jesus is saying is that you are going to continue to hunger and thirst if you come to anything but the Lord Jesus, the bread of life himself. And so, basically what I'm saying is the idea that these philosophical arguments or scientific arguments are not biblically based is not true. You can find in the scriptures that type of reasoning from the biblical authors, because the effect, that which God has created, points us to the cause, God himself. Okay, so just take about an 8-minute break to about 8:15. All I want to do right now, and I'm just going to probably just spend 10 minutes on this, is just tell you how I use these traditional arguments, plus a few other things, in my cumulative case for God. So if you just turn the page in your notes, you'll see the cumulative case for God. I've been using this since my debate with Michael Martin in 1997. No one's ever refuted it in open debate. But then again, no one's ever attempted to refute it. I don't know what it is that these atheists don't understand what I'm saying, or they just choose not to attack this argument. So anytime somebody tells me they think I lost the debate, I'll say, okay, well, then you explain to me how the atheist refuted my cumulative case for God. And they usually don't even know what I'm talking about. And then I tell them, next time you go to a debate, pay attention. And the cumulative case, what I do is I try to take the debate out of the criminal courts and move it into the civil courts. What I mean by that is in the criminal courts, you have to prove your case beyond all reasonable doubt. Okay? Why did O.J. Simpson not get convicted of murdering his wife and her friend? What's that?
Reasonable doubt?
Yeah. The when they interviewed the jurors, they were first I thought they were idiots, but they were very intelligent people. Every one that they interviewed, they asked, you know, do you believe he did it? And said, oh, yeah, he did it. Well, why did you find him not guilty? He said, because he hired 5 of the world's greatest lawyers, and each one raised just a little bit of reasonable doubt. And you put that all together, there was too much reasonable doubt to convict. But yeah, I think he did. But what I'm getting at is, if in a debate I'm supposed to prove that God exists beyond all reasonable doubt, then I could create a situation where the atheist just relaxes and just raises just enough reasonable doubt. You know, what am I shooting for? Am I shooting for like 95% proof? Well, what if the guy, if the atheist produces 6 or 7% doubt, then do I lose the debate? To me, that's not a fair way to deal with the truth. That's a fair way to deal with human beings. You don't want to throw a guy behind bars if he's not the guy. You certainly don't want to execute him if there's reasonable doubt. But when we're dealing with truth, and if I've got my worldview, theism, belief in God, and the atheist has his worldview where he doesn't believe in God, if my view is more convincing than his view, why should I lose the debate? And so I like to take it into the civil courts where you just have to prove your case based on the preponderance of the evidence. Okay? So in other words, all I'm trying to say is, look, let's go mano a mano, theism versus atheism, and we'll use the preponderance of the evidence. I'm going to treat Christian theism as a hypothesis, as an explanation, and I'm going to argue that theism, belief in God, is a more reasonable explanation than atheism is. That's all I'm arguing for. Now, if my name were William Lane Craig, and I were as brilliant as he is, then I can argue for God's existence beyond all reasonable doubt. But I'm not as brilliant as him. So I'm just going to argue that theism offers a more adequate explanation than atheism does for common aspects of human experience. So in other words, I'm using the same arguments that we covered and then maybe a few more besides that, but I'm not trying to conclude, therefore God has to exist. And I've convinced you, right, that God did. Well, I'm arguing that, look, you admit the universe had a beginning. You, Mr. Atheist, admit the universe had a beginning. I admit the universe had a beginning. If it had a beginning, it didn't just pop into existence out of nothing, totally out of cause. It's more reasonable to believe that God created the universe than to believe that nothing created the universe. And so I don't even have to prove that it's impossible for nothing to create the universe. I can just say it's more reasonable that the Creator created the universe rather than nothing created the universe. And so what I do is I look at the beginning of the universe. We're just running through these now because we already covered them in the traditional arguments. I say, look, the universe had a beginning. Therefore, theism is a better explanation than atheism. The universe continues to exist. Therefore, it's more reasonable than some necessary infinite being grounds the continuing existence of everything else that exists, rather than the universe just continues to exist and we don't have any explanation why. The design and order we find in the universe, it's more likely that there's an intelligent designer than it just looks like order and design, but it's not really order and design. I mean, we can recognize order and design. You don't need a PhD in the scientific field. You can look at the Grand Canyon and say, okay, Something happened here. There's non-rational causes that could explain the Grand Canyon, how it at least got that way. Not how it came into existence, but how it got that way. But you can tell me Richard Dawkins is going to look at the faces on Mount Rushmore and say, oh yeah, that's not designed. No, he's going to say the faces on Mount Rushmore, they're intelligently designed. The Grand Canyon isn't. That was caused by erosion or whatever, maybe even the global flood, for all we know. But Richard Dawkins could see the difference between intelligent design and something that got here by natural causes. Well, then, you look at a single-celled animal, it contains way more information than the faces on Mount Rushmore. The whole universe being fine-tuned for human life on the planet Earth, Richard Dawkins says that's an illusion. The appearance of design is an illusion. It's not really that way. Well, science is supposed to be learning, attaining knowledge through the five senses. If he's telling us the five senses are deceiving us, he shouldn't be a scientist at all. In fact, he says design is an illusion. Why doesn't he just become a Hindu? Says the whole physical world is an illusion. I mean, to me, that'd be a logical step to take. But the design and order of the universe shows that theism, belief in an intelligent designer, is more reasonable than everything got here by chance. The fact that human reason works makes theism more reasonable than atheism. The existence of universal, eternal, unchanging truths. Okay? It's more reasonable that God exists. I mean, most atheists believe 1 + 1 really does equal 2. And there was never a time when 1 + 1 equals something other than 2. St. Augustine was a Platonist. He was Platonic in his thought. Plato taught the existence of eternal, unchanging ideas. Okay? So, Plato taught this particular chair is a chair because it has chairness. And it's less than fully real. The fully rare, because you could take the material that went into this chair. It doesn't have to be this way. You can take it and melt it and make a table. So Plato would say this particular chair isn't fully real. The fully real thing is the eternal, unchanging idea chair. That all the individual, particular, physical chairs participate in that idea. Well, Augustine, though he was Platonic and much of his thought, was also a Christian. So he said, yeah, this is fully real, because God created a fully real universe. At the same time, Augustine realized when the first man came up with the idea to build a chair, that God wasn't up in heaven saying, oh, wow, why didn't I think of that? How come I never had that idea? So Augustine is saying, he acknowledges that in God's mind there are these eternal, invisible, unchanging truths. But Augustine said, Plato's got the eternal, unchanging truths just hanging there. But eternal, unchanging ideas. But ideas must exist in minds. So if there's eternal, unchanging ideas, they didn't come from finite, changing minds. They must come from an eternal, unchanging mind, i.e. the mind of God. But just the existence of these eternal, unchanging truths, the laws of logic and mathematics. Most atheists are materialists. Only matter exists. What about thoughts and values and truths? So if atheism is true, then there would be no such thing as truth, but then atheism could not be true. And so just the existence of eternal, unchanging, atheists, like I said, only physical things exist. Well, that you're expressing an idea. Your idea that only physical material things exist, that idea itself is not a material thing. Right? That's why I asked Dan Barker in my debate with him, how much does a thought weigh? And the audience started laughing at me, like, what a dumb, stupid Christian. These Christians are so stupid. They think you can weigh thoughts. But I asked Dan Barker, how much does a thought weigh? Well, they stopped laughing when Dan Barker said, oh, you can weigh a thought. Because I did some, background research on Dan Barker. He's a materialist. He's a consistent atheist. So he believes only physical things exist. And so I said, so are you telling me that a thought or a choice or an idea is nothing but a chemical reaction that occurs inside someone's brain? And he said, yeah, basically. But he kept bringing up, this is before 9/11, so he kept bringing up Timothy McVeigh as an example of evil, blowing up the Oklahoma City building. And so I said, well then, why are you so tough on Timothy McVeigh when, if your view is correct, he was just responding to a brain squirt? In other words, if our ideas and our choices are nothing but chemical reactions inside our brain, then they're biologically determined. We're not responsible for our choices. You know, one guy chooses to help an elderly lady across the road, another guy chooses to mug her and steal her groceries. Neither one of them is responsible for either doing good or evil, because they're just chemical reactions going on inside their brain, biologically determined. So consistent atheists can't acknowledge these such a thing as truth. Most atheists are not consistent. But the existence of the eternal, unchanging truths makes theism, belief in God, more reasonable than atheism. Same with moral laws, meaning in life, a reason to be optimistic about the future, to have hope, or a guarantee that evil will be defeated. If atheism is true, evil will not be defeated. In the end, evil wins. Feelings of guilt. I did not think feelings of guilt was a good argument for God until I started reading Sigmund Freud. And then I was shocked at how much time he spent and energy arguing. Because guilt is knowledge that you've done wrong. If you do wrong and no one's looking and no one is hurt by the wrong that you did, you still feel guilty. And I would argue that persons are more important than things, and rules are things. So if you broke a rule and no person got hurt, why do you still feel guilty? And I would argue that deep down inside, there's three persons that you've actually hurt: the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And fear of death. When a person is dying, they call for a priest or a preacher. They don't call for their favorite atheist philosopher. Again, when we have fear of death, it's not dying. Some of us are going to die without pain. We fear what comes on the other side. King Solomon said God put eternity in man's heart. Deep down inside, my dog doesn't think, gee, I wonder if there's life after death. What happens after I die? Humans do. And the reason why we do is we were created to be eternal beings. Human rights, respect for human life. In a world without God, there are no human rights. If I kick a mound of dirt, it's no big deal. But if you come to church and you see me kicking a child, it's a real big deal. Okay? But if atheism is true, a child is really no different than a mound of dirt. It's just mere molecules of motion. Why all the fuss? Why human rights? And then free will, human responsibility. If there's no non-material soul in humans, then all our actions are biologically determined. We're not free. Therefore, we're not responsible for our actions. Therefore, we should set the prisoners free. So, my conclusion in the cumulative case is that mere molecules of motion combined with time and chance cannot explain any of these factors. The atheist must either deny the reality of these aspects of human experience and say there are no moral absolutes, there are no eternal unchanging truths, the universe didn't have a beginning. They either have to deny these aspects of human experience, or they can say, yeah, I believe in them, but they're just there. But then the atheism becomes like a non-explanation, and a worldview is supposed to be an explanation. Bertrand Russell, in his debate in 1948, with Frederick Copleston, the Jesuit priest on the existence of God, Copleston asked him, what should we say then about the origin of the universe, the beginning of the universe? And Bertrand Russell said, we should say it's just there. Which is a pretty dumb statement. But I would say, to be consistent with your atheism, Bertrand Russell should say about, well, what about moral laws? Well, they're just there. Instead, what Bertrand Russell said, they're not real. But if you admit that they're really, you'd say, well, they're just there. Well, what about design and order? Well, it's just that. It's just there. It's just there. Your worldview really stinks. So there's the two options. Either you deny obvious aspects of human experience, and you're denying the obvious, or you say they're just there, and atheism becomes a non-explanation. But I think it's not too difficult to show. If you look at these common aspects of human experience, that belief in God is much more reasonable than atheism is. Okay, so I actually did run longer than I expected. Apologize for that.